which of course, as you all know, has been a problem in the Milwaukee courthouse yesterday, about which we feel very badly about the injuries. So, we will now call our first case, 99-3164, State v. John Laxton. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Laxton is Assistant State Public Defender Margaret Maroney, whom we haven't seen since yesterday. Ms. Maroney.
May it please the Court, I'd like to first introduce Assistant State Public Defender Jeffrey Olson, who is seated at council table. I appreciate his presence.
We haven't seen him since yesterday.
This case is before the court on a petition for review. The court accepted review and asked the parties to address the question whether the petitioner's due process rights were violated because there was no jury determination regarding his level of volitional control over his sexually dangerous behavior. And I am going to start out with basically a concession. The jury instruction committee came out on February 20th with a revised jury instruction. And 8 days later, I filed Mr. Laxton's brief in chief. I've had a lot of time to think since then. And I honestly cannot argue that due process requires a separate finding on serious difficulty in controlling dangerous behavior. I believe it would be better if there were a separate finding, just like we have in the NGI context. But in terms of due process, what's important is that the jury find this fact, that the jury find that Mr. Laxton had a serious difficulty in controlling behavior. And so I think what the Wisconsin Jury Instruction Committee did satisfies due process. Whether this court believes a separate finding would be a good idea so that the jury's attention is focused to that issue, I think that does not rise to the level of due process.
Counsel?
Yes.
I looked at the case, which is the foundation, I guess, of our presence here today, the Kansas versus Crane case. And in reading the dissent and how it characterizes the majority opinion, it appears to me that the dissent can be read to characterize the majority opinion as requiring a separate lack of control determination. And that reading can come from both part two and part three of the dissent. Number one, do you agree that that's how the dissent characterizes the majority opinion?
I do.
And apparently you don't agree that the dissent is correct in characterizing majority opinion in that way, because you start your argument with saying it's not required, and the dissent characterizes the majority opinion as indicating that it is required. Could you respond?
Your Honor, I think that whether something is incorporated into a definition of the mental condition or whether it is separated, as long as it's telling the jury that the mental disorder has to currently render the person seriously unable to control their dangerous behavior, that due process is satisfied. And
let me again try. So you agree that I've correctly said what the dissent characterizes as the majority opinion.
Correct.
And the dissent characterizes the majority opinion as requiring a separate lack of control determination. Do you agree with that?
I do. I agree.
Okay.
And I wish
now,
that
let me take one step further. Do you think the majority opinion requires a separate lack of control determination?
I argued so in my brief. I think the dissent, if it were the majority opinion, would definitely, without a doubt, say that it has to be a separate finding. It seems when you read Kansas versus Crane and Kansas versus Hendricks, one of the points that's made is that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to give the states a lot of leeway in how they define the mental condition that provides that something extra that allows for the preventive detention of a person who's sexually dangerous. So in light of the, to me, the United States Supreme Court has carefully let out little bits of information as to what due process requires. And in Kansas versus Hendricks, the court said there has to be a lack of control.
So the question is, does the majority opinion require a separate lack of control determination?
A separate. Well, I'm going to look. It requires a determination. And in fact, I think in the briefs there was, I had miscited a case, and I corrected that in my reply brief. I had referred to the Kansas Supreme Court decision in Crane as opposed to the United States Supreme Court. And what the United States Supreme Court said, and this is in the reply brief on page 2, we do not agree with the state, however, insofar as it seeks to claim that the Constitution permits commitment of the type of dangerous sexual offender considered in Hendricks without any lack of control determination. So I think that that gives the states some leeway in how the jury is going to make that determination, whether it's going to be as part of the jury instructions on the elements, or if it's a sub-element of the mental disorder. But I'm not contending that our definition of mental disorder is adequate. My strong position is it does not communicate the essential element of a serious lack of control. Yes, Your Honor?
The instruction or the statute?
I contend both are. Now, Mr. Laxton, I think, has a very strong argument as to why the actual jury instructions given in his case were deficient, but that gets into the area of whether or not the jury was properly instructed on sexually violent offenses and whether or not they should have been, whether or not the jury could have been confused that an act of voyeurism or exhibitionism could have been a sexually violent offense. But looking just at the statute, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, when you go over the jury instruction, I'm looking particularly at the page 28 of the United States brief.
Did you say page 20 or
28. Okay. Well, it's talking about the relevant jury instruction. And the argument they're making is that if the jury did make the lack of control determination.
Right.
Can I read? And now, tell me why you think it did not. What's deficient? What's deficient in this instruction?
There is nothing there in terms of the disorder that asks the jury to decide whether or not Mr. Laxton presently has a serious difficulty in controlling his dangerous behavior. I know in the briefs there was discussion about the term effect, and my argument being that it doesn't say which way, positive or negative, and the state saying, well, common understanding would be negatively. Even if the court accepts the state's argument that effect means negative, it's not enough because it doesn't say anything about the degree. If Mr. Laxton only had the slightest difficulty in controlling his behavior, as opposed to a serious difficulty, he should not have been committed.
Well, counsel, when I look at the bottom of page 28 again, the third fact that must be established is that the respondent is dangerous to others because he has a mental disorder, which creates a substantial probability that he will, etc. What is wrong with that? That seems to link it, and as I understand your argument, there's no linkage here. There's no nexus. And of course, for purposes of my question, I'm assuming that substantial probability means the same thing as serious difficulty.
I'm sorry, could you repeat yourself?
For purposes of my question, I am assuming, without deciding, that substantial probability means serious difficulty.
I do not accept that assumption. But
because I want to get past that and I want to get
sure.
your argument, which I think is the strongest argument that you have, that there is not the required nexus.
Yes, Your Honor. The substantial probability is a prediction of future dangerousness. It does not address the current condition of the person. And so, there are things that could be in place at the present moment that reduce a person's dangerousness, such as taking medication that reduces the sex drive, or going to a support group once a day for sexual addiction problems. A jury could conclude that that person presently has the ability to control their dangerous behavior.
Well,
now, if there was
the language of the instruction doesn't say that he did have, but not necessarily doesn't have now. It says Mr. Laxton is dangerous to others because he has, present tense, he has a mental disorder, which creates a substantial probability.
So yes.
How could they have not?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
No, that's fine.
I'm going to just follow up on that. The mental disorder is not defined in a way that tells the jury it has to be an ability to control their behavior. Now, if you look at the expert testimony, pedophilia is the example I'll use. The experts testify that there's recurrent fantasies, urges, and behaviors. If there's fantasies and Mr. Laxton is able to control his behavior, he should not be committed. If he even has urges and is able to talk them out. Yes, Your Honor.
I just, in the same instruction, and just going up a couple of paragraphs, it says, disorders do not include merely deviant behaviors that conflict with prevailing societal mores. In other words, the jury is not bound by medical labels, definitions. I'm just reading. So the jury, I think, has to look at something obviously more serious. And what you're saying, well, yes, maybe fantasies are barely deviant behaviors. And we're talking about someone here who had done something more than have fantasies.
Yes. Your Honor, I think Justice Thomas in the Hendricks case makes a statement that's relevant to your concern. And that is, he talks about how legal definitions have to be different than medical definitions. And the reason is that the legal definition includes the concepts of individual responsibility and That is found at 117 Supreme Court 2081. I think that concept of responsibility is an important concept in this case. In the area of civil commitments, we have committed people who are dangerous when they are not responsible for their dangerous behavior because of a mental illness. And the jury has been asked to make that finding in the context of a 971-17 not guilty by reason of insanity jury instruction. Now, I want to point out something that is very significant in terms of whether or not mental disorder itself is enough. If you look at the experts, the introduction to the most recent version of the diagnostic statistical manual, DSM-4-TR, which stands for Text Revised, in the introduction, they warn that even when diminished control over one's behavior is a feature of the disorder, having the diagnosis in itself does not demonstrate that a particular individual is or was unable to control his or her behavior at a particular time. The psychiatrists disavow that a legal connection should be drawn as a result of the diagnosis.
I'm still very unclear, counsel, as to precisely what you're arguing here, based upon the opening of your argument, which contained the concession.
Sure, I understand.
You said that you've reviewed the jury instruction as modified by the jury instruction committee pursuant to Kansas versus Crane, and you have concluded that it is adequate. And I understood that to mean that you are no longer conceding that there is a problem with this statute being unconstitutional, and that you don't concede, and that you are conceding that the revised instruction is also adequate. And so what we've got left in this case is mere instructional error because your client didn't get that modified instruction, and so then we apply the harmless error rule of Nader.
Thank you.
We can all go home.
Thank you very
apparently
much.
That's not your argument.
That was an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked it. I jumped right in the middle. I, in the brief, make the constitutional challenge to the statute, and I still make that argument. However, I think it's the jury instruction issue which is the one the court really has to wrestle with. And so my jury instruction issue is, assuming the court says our statute's constitutional, no, because it's so similar to Kansas's statute, which is held constitutional in Hendricks.
And Crane.
And Crane. Then what about the jury instructions? So I apologize for not being clear on that. It is not an abandonment of the first issue at all. It's just a refinement of my second issue on the jury instructions, and that is that it doesn't have to be a separate question like I set forth in my brief.
Okay, and is your constitutional argument based on the state constitution, since the United States Supreme Court did not invalidate the Kansas statute in either Hendricks or Crane, but rather explicitly upheld it?
Well, no, I base it on both, and I do not believe that because the Supreme Court upheld Kansas statute in Hendricks on a particular challenge, that means it's constitutional as to other challenges. The issue in Hendricks was basically what this court had wrestled with 2 years earlier in Post, whether or not due process requires a finding of mental illness. And Hendricks said, no, it doesn't. We don't put any special weight on the term mental illness or mental disorder, and the states are free to define it. But they said Kansas statute was okay, is rather casual. It was constitutional. I'm going to ask the court to look on page 24 of my brief if you want to actually see what I'm going to quote. The Kansas statute defined mental abnormality as a congenital or acquired condition, which is similar to Wisconsin, affecting the emotional or volitional capacity, similar to Wisconsin, predisposes the person to commit sexually violent offenses. That's incorporated in our definition. And then the following: in a degree constituting such a person a menace to the health and safety of others. That phrase there, in a degree, communicates the serious difficulty, which was picked up then in, well, it was picked up by the Kansas Supreme Court when they decided Crane. And they said that he was entitled to a new trial because the jury had not been instructed. They had to decide whether he had the ability to control his dangerous behavior. The United States Supreme Court said, you read too far. There has to be a serious problem, serious difficulty in controlling your dangerous behavior, but it doesn't have to be an utter lack of control. So we're going to reverse it and remand it. Now that
they vacated and remanded.
I'm sorry, thank you very much. Vacated and remanded. And I think that the mandate is significant because if the court thought it was sufficient for the jury to be instructed as they were, it would have just reversed the Kansas Supreme Court and said you were
what
wrong.
What the dissent wanted.
That's right. So this case requires the court to look carefully at Kansas versus Hendricks, Kansas versus Crane, our statute, the jury instruction given in this case, and decide exactly what it is the Supreme Court is telling us due process requires. And it has said that we're giving general guidelines. And the general guideline is that a person has to have a serious difficulty in controlling their behavior and that the jury has to make that determination. And that is an important point with the statute at issue. After Mr. Lack...
Counsel, if I may. I'm still, I guess, following up on Justice Sykes' question, making sure I know where we are in this case. Your brief, section 1, that takes us through page 26, attacks the constitutionality of the statute, but you seem to today be acknowledging that might not be your strongest argument because the statute in both Hendricks and Crane was determined constitutional. The next section of your brief, taking us to page 36, indicates there has to be a separate finding, but today you're saying there doesn't have to be a separate finding. Within that section, up until page 36, actually starting on about page 35, you argue that the revised pattern jury instruction does not satisfy the due process requirement. I understand you today to be saying to the contrary, that it does meet the due process requirement. That leaves us with section 3 of your brief, that in the interest of justice. So what? I'm just having a difficulty knowing what the argument
is. Okay, my argument is that the statute is unconstitutional. And that is a separate argument. The remedy would be, for Mr. Laxton, a discharge. And that is the remedy he seeks. I do not wish to communicate anything other than that to the court. Now, the second issue is on the adequacy of the jury instructions that were given at his trial. The remedy there would be give him a new trial. And I am saying that they were deficient because the jury did not determine that Mr. Laxton had a serious difficulty in controlling his serious.
I think one of your problems, at least as I read it and listen to it, is the jury did not determine. Quotes. The jury is given broad instructions, and they appear in the state's brief, they appear in your brief, and then when the jury is instructed, the jury just comes back with what? What's the verdict?
Oh, you know, I want to say that it's a single verdict of he's a sexually violent predator.
That's right. It's a single verdict. They don't say, did he have a mental disorder? They don't say, was it clinically significant? They don't find whether it's dangerous because he had a mental disorder, which creates a substantial problem. It's not a special verdict. Jury is instructed, and they come back with one verdict. Like guilty or not guilty, but here it is whether he should be committed, right?
Yes.
Okay. So did the jury, in making that decision, make a determination about mental condition? I think when you keep saying the jury determines this, the jury determines that, I hear that they've got to make a special verdict finding. Now, do they have to make a special verdict finding about the 90 days?
They are instructed that it's a separate element.
Do they make a finding about the 90 days?
I do not know if there is a form verdict that is being used. I do not know.
All right, but my point is, when you say the jury determines, they do it ordinarily, not under what you talk about, what is it, the not guilty?
Right.
Instruction, where they may make special verdict determinations, right? In commitments under 971.17.
Right. The jury's instructed to answer the separate questions.
They don't do that now in the sexual.
Right.
Okay. And as I read your initial brief, you thought they should and must.
I still think they should.
Okay.
I still think
they should. They might make it better.
Pardon me?
They might make it better, might make it easier to make sure that the jury is doing it correctly, which is why you do that in civil cases, etc.
Okay. That's right.
Your position now is they need not. It is not a requirement under due process.
Yes. I am saying that if the jury determines it after being told what the component is.
If the jury determines that he's a sexual offender that ought to be committed, it's okay as long as the jury is instructed that somewhere that the state had approved serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
No, there is a limit. You can't just, like, lump everything together.
Okay.
And I guess what I'd like to say about that.
All I'm trying to do is pin you down, not on that, whether it can be lumped together. I'm just trying to say, so that we understand what your position is. As I hear it, your position is the jury has to be properly instructed in these words, serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
Correct.
That is an element of the state's proof. Okay. And that if the jury is so instructed, then that is, at least under the jury instruction part of your brief, okay.
Correct. Thank you.
That is your position?
Yes, Your Honor. It is. And I guess I would like to point out in terms of definitions of terms that it is not, there are many terms which we might all agree on the meaning, consent, for example, in the context of a sexual assault. But the legal significance of it is complex. The jury instruction committee has a whole separate jury instruction to explain the concept to the jury. We have to remember that the jury is a group of lay people. They are not lawyers. They are not judges. And I think the fact, I think this record, where we have an extended conversation between the lawyers and the judge over the meaning of sexually violent or acts of sexual violence,
can you really highlight the next issue?
Well, it demonstrates the fact. Yes, Your Honor.
Oh,
Red, stop. Red. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justices.
Assistant Attorney General Eileen W. Prey, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Prey.
Good morning. I'm Assistant Attorney General Lee Prey, and I represent the state. And I would just like to begin by explaining what the state has to prove to commit a person in the state of Wisconsin as a sexually violent predator.
It's a little difficult to hear. Could you scream that a little bit? I'm having trouble.
I'm sorry. I'll try. I will speak up.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to begin by explaining what the state of Wisconsin, the state has to prove in order to commit somebody as a sexually violent person in the state of Wisconsin under Chapter 980. The statute, and in this case and in most cases, the standard jury instructions which follow the statute before the revised jury instructions, require that the state prove that because of a person's mental disorder, and that because it's important, it's part of the nexus, that the person have a condition affecting their volitional capacity or their emotional capacity, and that these impairments predispose the person to commit acts of sexual violence. But it doesn't stop there. The disorder must create a substantial probability, and much more likely than not, that the person will commit acts of sexual violence in the future. There is a nexus there. There is a linkage. We are not committing people merely because they commit or have committed sexually violent offenses in the past.
Now, what's the difference between volitional capacity or emotional capacity? So suppose we found that there was no effect on volitional capacity, but it affects emotional capacity.
In almost every case, you can't separate them out. And Crane says this, in fact. In the second part of the opinion, Crane said it doesn't really make sense to try to parse out what is the emotional impairment, what's the cognitive impairment, what's the volitional impairment.
All three of them have to have proof of serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
That is correct. And it is
so this statute really shouldn't have even used emotional capacity.
I don't believe that is true. I think that there isn't an emotional component in many of these sex offenses and people with disorders that do sex offenses. I believe that in almost all of them there is also a volitional kind of impairment, a sexual urge that is uncontrollable in some way.
Or an emotional capacity that's uncontrollable.
Or emotional capacity, and I'm not quite sure how the psychiatrist would explain what that is in and of itself. It may be that you have a difficulty having empathy with your victim.
But could a jury think that it's just totally different? You know, here I am, juror. I may be learned in the law, but I'm not very learned as the difference between volitional capacity or emotional capacity. And if I see a word separated, I think they're very different.
That may be true, but I don't think that the constitutionality of our statute hinges on having a volitional impairment.
What about the jury instruction? As I read your brief, the state's view, and if I read it wrong, you should tell me. State's view is that implicit in this instruction, implicit in the statute,
right,
implicit instruction is the concept that a jury would understand of that the state has to prove serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
That's correct.
That's your position.
That is my position.
So a jury hearing that because of mental disorder, having a condition affecting volitional capacity or emotional capacity, et cetera, so means that there's serious difficulty in controlling behavior.
I don't think we can parse out one piece. I think it has to be put together. You
the
have
whole
to have
thing
put the whole
tells
thing
put, that to the jury.
I think absolutely there. I do not, and I don't think Mr. Laxton has pointed out one person that could be committed under our statute that didn't also necessarily have difficulty controlling their behavior. I don't think there is such a person.
The serious difficulty.
Serious difficulty, and you get at the degree of seriousness by linking the disorder to the substantial probability, and in that sense, our statute is even stronger in the degree of seriousness than Kansas's is. Kansas's is much more likely than not.
Suppose I had statistics that showed burglars have a high probability of repeating the crime until they're age 43. Then it drops down.
All right.
So I have linked a crime with a substantial probability, substantial likelihood that they're going to commit it again. That's not good enough, right?
No, it is not, because you haven't linked that dangerousness with a mental disorder that has a predisposition to do the type of offense that we're talking about.
I thought you would say I haven't linked that there's a serious difficulty in controlling behavior, because in burglary there are recidivists, but we think they can control their behavior, whereas here we think they cannot. Well, that's what the jury has to think.
That's correct, and I guess I shortened that by talking about the mental disorder, which encompasses, I think, in this case, the serious difficulty controlling behavior. It's the linkage between the dangerousness and the mental disorder which distinguishes our statute and Kansas's statute from the typical recidivist who belongs in prison.
And in this case, as I look at the testimony of both the state's experts and the defense experts, the one thing I think there was some commonality was that certainly there was pointed out a lack of control or impulsivity. That's what I gathered. And that's, they said, notwithstanding the fact that this type of behavior, and I'll just characterize, could be other people that have it, but this particular person, as I think one of them testified, it affected both his emotional and volitional capacity, not distinguishing between the two, and that he obviously cannot stop himself from committing these acts and getting in so much trouble that where he intended to expose himself to the first victim, he became sexually aroused, but then could not adequately restrain himself from more violent sexual acts.
That's absolutely true.
That's what the jury is.
In this particular case, there's no doubt that this person has difficulty and serious difficulty controlling his dangerous behavior. And as you pointed out, the fact that he only intended to expose himself, I don't mean by only that that's not serious, but that's what he had intended to do, and that he ended up not being able to follow through on those intentions, and his sexual urges took over, and he acted upon those sexual urges to sexually assault those two 12-year-olds. I submit that in every case there will be evidence and proof that the volitional and emotional problems were to such an extent that they had a predisposition to do sexual acts, and that they could not will have to be found under our statute and the jury instructions that they cannot control those urges sufficiently so that the jury has to find that they're substantially probable to commit sexual acts in the future.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that line of questioning. And in your brief on page 37, you say, well, there is testimony with regard to the issue that Justice Wilcox referenced. Then the next page, you say, because of this allegedly mistaken belief, I think that it was not necessary to prove lack of control as a separate element, you say, because of this allegedly mistaken belief, the state would not have been given a fair opportunity to present competent evidence on the lack of control issue. So it seems it may not be inconsistent, but help me.
It does, and this comes into the res judicata argument double jeopardy argument, that you couldn't retry the person. And I'm only saying, if this court were to find that the proof that we put in every case, that somehow there's some other kind of proof out there that needs to be put forth in order to prove serious difficulty in controlling behavior. I don't think there is. The state doesn't think there is. But if this court determines that, then it would not be a problem with the proof. It would be a problem that the court and the state and the defense
mistaken the
criteria.
Let me just crystallize that, then, if I may. Is it your position, if this court finds that the interpretation of the majority opinion is, as the dissent suggests, a separate element has to be found, mm-hmm. is it your position that you have been given a fair opportunity to present competent evidence on the lack of control issue? And in this case?
I don't think we would have. If somebody out there can explain to the state and the parties what this separate element of proof consists of that isn't already being proved under the statutory criteria.
If this court interprets the majority opinion as requiring a separate element, is it your position that there is sufficient record in this case upon which you can rest, and that the record presents evidence sufficient to meet the requirement of a separate element?
I believe so. Again, the problem I have with answering these questions is I cannot conceive of what the proof for a separate element
can help out. So your position is, even if the defendant is correct, that some instruction had to be made or given as to proof of serious difficulty in controlling behavior. Your position is, one, it's harmless error that
correct.
It wasn't given because the proof is such that no jury could find otherwise.
Correct.
And your second position is, even if we don't accept that this man should not be released. He should be sent back for another commitment hearing.
Correct.
Oh, that the total statement that explains your view on that?
I don't think we ever get to that point.
To the question?
Well, excuse me?
Are you listening carefully to the
question? Well, maybe not. I may have missed something. I'm not conceding that's the direction that the court should go.
I know that. But if the court should say you have to give this separate jury instruction of one sort or other on serious difficulty, you're saying it's harmless error that it wasn't made here.
Correct.
Because the jury could only find that it was.
I'm saying that it's harmless error if this court finds that the jury needs to be instructed separately at serious difficulty controlling behavior.
I understand that your first line of defense
Correct.
Is that this jury was adequately instructed?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The statute is totally constitutional.
Absolutely.
But if the court should disagree with you about the jury instruction, you think it's harmless error?
Yes.
And if the court should say it's not harmless error, then you don't want him released, which is what the defendant's, what Laxton's position is.
That's right.
But that's only fallback positions.
Exactly.
I understand.
Okay.
And so in response to Justice Bradley, those were fallback positions you are alleging.
Yes, yes. Exactly, and that there is some inconsistency because the state believes that when they have proved the elements in the statute and when the jury has been instructed by those elements, they have necessarily. Serious difficulty controlling behavior is subsumed into the criteria of the statute and in the criteria that the jury is given, and that a jury is required to follow the instructions that they are given. So if they are instructed that they have to find somebody has a mental disorder and has certain inflictions and predispositions, serious sexual predispositions, and that causes them to be much more likely to not commit sexually violent offenses, they have to make those findings in making that one verdict form that the person is a sexually violent person.
If I understand your argument further, can you say the state statute is perfectly constitutional because the U.S. Supreme Court twice has upheld a similar one, maybe even one that's not as good as ours?
That's right.
And your position is that under state constitutional law, we should not reach a different result.
And I think Post says that they're very similar.
And if I understand your brief, you say that if the statute is constitutional, even though it doesn't use the terms proof of serious difficulty in controlling behavior,
mm-hmm.
the statute's constitutional, then why shouldn't these instructions, which are in the exact words of the statute, be constitutional?
I believe that's one way of expressing my argument.
That's right. Not the only way, but one way. Your second argument, or another argument, is that implicit in the instructions is the concept of serious difficulty in controlling behavior, and that's how you began your argument.
Yes.
Implicit.
Yes.
Not explicit. Those words aren't used, but implicit.
And
implicit and serious probability, implicit in volitional and emotional capacity in mental disorder.
That's correct. And I don't think there's any requirement anywhere that those magic words, serious difficulty controlling behavior, appear in a statute or a jury instruction. That would fly in the face of the teachings of the United States Supreme Court that in this area particularly of mental disabilities, disorders, illnesses, that the state has the ability to define the terms. And what's important is that the basic concepts underneath those terms are applied. And with due process, the basic concept is that the statute cannot encompass people who don't have that serious difficulty. Just behavior.
Tell you what bothers me about your argument, and that is that it seems to me that you are taking the position of the Scalia dissent.
Well,
and that Mr. Laxton is not quite taking the position of the Breyer majority, but in oral argument is moving closer to it than in the brief. So here's what the dissent said. The dissent says this. What the opinion was obviously saying was that the Kansas
statutes required finding of a causal connection between the likelihood of repeat acts of sexual violence and the existence of mental abnormality or personality disorder necessarily establishes, quote, difficulty, if not impossibility in controlling behavior. It could not be clearer that in the court's estimation, the very existence of a mental abnormality or personality disorder that causes a likelihood of repeat sexual violence in itself establishes the requisite difficulty, if not impossibility, of control. And that's, isn't that what you're saying?
I think that's right, and I think the dissent misinterprets the majority opinion, and of course we're not held by the dissent's interpretation of what the majority said.
But you see, that's what you were saying here. I think you're saying exactly what the dissent said.
I think we're saying pretty much what the dissent says the majority should say, but thought that it didn't say.
Okay.
And I think
I'll
the dissent,
all that.
And I think the dissent,
the
was,
dissent said the majority should have done, but it didn't.
And I think that the dissent is wrong in the sense that it misinterpreted the majority in finding that there has to be a separate element.
Okay. But somewhere the jury has to be told something about a serious, or at least the state has to prove it.
The state has to prove it,
right.
And what all that Crane says, and to step back again, all that Crane did was, number one, it reaffirmed Hendricks holding that the definition of mental abnormality was constitutional. Number two, it disabused the Kansas Supreme Court of the notion that you had to always prove a total lack of control. And number three, it disabused the state of Kansas that they didn't have to prove any lack of control or make any lack of control determination. The two critical phrases in the Crane opinion is there has to be proof of serious difficulty in controlling behavior, and there has to be, and there can't be any lack, that there has to be a lack of control determination. Under our statute, both of those things happen. There is proof and has to be proof that the person has serious difficulty controlling the behavior. That is the only way that they can meet our statutory requirements.
So let me give a hypothetical, and I have the statute. I'll read it. The person is dangerous to others because the person's mental disorder creates a substantial probability that he or she will engage in acts of sexual violence. And you said that the jury instruction parrots or
right.
follows that. So.
Right.
Now, the whole thing about the Crane case is you've got to, what distinguishes sexual predator, which makes this a civil commitment rather than smelling of retribution and deterrence just because he's a dirty old man or she's a dirty old woman recidivist, is they just can't control themselves. That's what Crane is all about. Because unless you have that volitional absence of or lack of sufficient volitional control, if that doesn't come into it, then you're just a criminal recidivist. All the way off. If I'm close enough, I'll continue.
You're close to what I would say. What I would say is what distinguishes the typical recidivist, whatever that person is that you have to link it to a mental disorder.
Okay,
disorder is the thing that is causing the danger.
Yes, mental disorder, but then Crane talks about the lack of volitional control. Let's take this language, let me give you a hypothetical. Mm-hmm. As a circuit court judge, I would see on occasion I would think in the back of my mind this, and I hope I don't offend anyone. This guy is narcissistic. I mean, he thinks he's God's gift to women because I've had him in here how many times on a date rape, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could say, under this statutory definition, that this guy has a mental disorder. And let me say in my hypothetical,
that there are psychiatrists and psychologists who would say, this guy has a mental disorder. In narcissism, he just thinks that all women want to come onto him, okay? Uh-huh. And he's done it a number of times before. The person is dangerous to others because his mental disorder, narcissism, creates a substantial probability that he or she will engage in acts of sexual violence, continue to date rape. And yet, in my hypothetical, it's not a matter necessarily of lack of volitional control. He could control himself. Now, how does that kind of recidivism and date rape, because the guy thinks he's man's, or in other words, God's gift to creation, suffering from a mental disorder or personality disorder, how does that hypothetical,
if I'm buying all of the parts of your hypothetical, I think I wouldn't buy the last part, which is that he could control himself. Mm-hmm. This sort of brings into the idea that if a person is what appears to be making choices about things, that somehow equates with serious difficulty in controlling their behavior. The bottom line is whether the choices, the things that this person is apparently choosing to do, is being driven by his mental illness, by the sexual urges, by the fantasies, by whatever it is about that mental condition. And I also am not sure that I would buy that narcissism would be considered a mental disorder that would be qualified under our statute. You take, for instance, a pedophile, who I think Crane and Hendricks both realize or suggest is the kind of diagnosis where there are strong sexual urges, and just built within that diagnosis, most people with pedophilia would have serious difficulty controlling their behavior. A person who has pedophilia, is diagnosed with pedophilia, may make many, many choices that appear to be choices that they're personally making. But, for instance, they oftentimes groom their victims or put themselves into situations where they have access to child victims, or even choose careers in order to have access to child victims. But those choices that they are making are driven by their sexual urges, so that that person, we would say, the state would say, and I think Crane would say, has serious difficulty in controlling their behavior. So it's not a matter of, it's sometimes difficult to look at somebody and say, well, they're just choosing to do that. In our statute, those choices have to be linked back to the mental disorder, and it has to be the mental disorder that is driving those choices.
Counsel, what's the state's position on the revised jury instruction? You think that's a good idea?
The revised jury instruction, the state believes that the added language that is included in the mental disorder part of the jury instruction is superfluous and redundant, that it's not necessary. We don't have as much problem with it appearing there in future cases as we would if it was separated out as a separate element. In a separate element, we believe that it would be confusing to the jury and make them believe that somehow the state had to be proving something in addition to what they're already proving under the criteria of the statute. And I don't think.
But if it's implicit, why do you object to making it explicit? It's your position that it's implicit in the jury instruction and in the statute. And the jury would know that the state has to prove. You agree the state has to prove serious difficulty in controlling behavior. We don't have a question about that.
Right.
Okay. If that is implicit in the jury instruction.
Correct.
Why do you object to making it explicit?
I think that substantive due process does not require it, so that all the commitments that happen without that in it are valid, and there was a finding, and they satisfy substantive due process. I don't think the state has a real problem with, in future cases, it using
talking
that.
Talking about the future cases, I'm sorry, if I may admit. In future cases, do you object to a separate statement that it is the burden on the state to prove that the person has serious difficulty in controlling behavior as a result of the mental disorder?
We would object to it being an isolated, separate element, distinguished as a separate element.
You object to it as a separate sentence somewhere? Just saying what I just said.
We would prefer that it be similar to what the revised jury instruction is, in that it is part of the mental illness and part of the linkage. The two things that you have to be careful.
That language is superfluous.
What?
But you think it's superfluous.
We do think it's superfluous.
Okay, but you would prefer it there. I'm sorry.
Right. I think that it has to be drafted carefully for two reasons. One is that not to mislead the jury into thinking that they have to find something that the state is not already proving in order to prove the criteria. And secondly, I think by separating it off, you may jeopardize losing that linkage, which is what I think makes our statute satisfy substantive due process, is that the mental disorder, including this serious difficulty controlling behavior, is part of the linkage. It comes both into the mental illness part, in the difficulty in controlling, and the degree of difficulty, which comes into our dangerousness statute. So I think you have to have sort of the whole ball of wax together to make our statute constitutional. So in conclusion, the state is asking this court to hold that the Wisconsin Sexual Predator Statute, Chapter 980, satisfies constitutional due process because it only commits persons who have serious difficulty controlling their dangerous behavior.
I have another question.
Sure.
And again, this is one of your alternative arguments. Your alternative argument is that should the state be wrong, or should the court think the state's wrong, whether it's wrong or not, that this holding should be prospective.
Correct.
And you cite some cases. We had a case, and I think it was Goldie H., that indicated that should the court require special kinds of procedures at a hearing, that we don't have to go back and deal with every single case in which somebody is institutionalized, because they get annual reviews. Therefore, when the annual review comes up, just do it the way we say now. Mm-hmm. What about that kind of argument here?
Well, I guess I wasn't...
Only if you fail on everything else.
I guess I wasn't totally clear on saying that it should only be prospective. It really, what we're saying is it should only be applied to cases in the direct
pipeline. I
direct appellate pipeline, okay. And that it shouldn't be on collateral review. And I think that's the teaching of Harper, that these kind of constitutional issues should be applied only to cases that are on direct appeal.
And then there are reviews.
Absolutely. That is another, thank you, good point, that these standards will be applied prospectively in their annual petitions for release and petitions for discharge.
I don't think I see or hear any other questions of Ms. Bray. Thank you very much. Ms. Maroney, you have several moments in rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. There's a lot I'd like to say in response. I'll try to keep it organized. I will start out with explaining the relief that Mr. Laxton asks for. First, as argued in the first part of my brief, he asked this court to declare the statute unconstitutional, and as a result, he should be discharged from his commitment. Second, that the commitment violates due process because of jury instructions errors. And what I would like to
talk about right now are some of the points that the state made. The state is saying it was implicit in the jury instructions that there was serious difficulty in controlling because of the connection with the probability that it's going to happen. That those concepts say nothing about the serious difficulty that a person has controlling their behavior. A person may choose to commit crimes, and then they are the recidivists that Justice Bradley talked about. And I do inform the court that there are cases pending that involve people who do not have the type of psychiatric disorder that is characterized by urges to commit sexually violent offenses. There are people committed and who are, cases are pending before the court that are committed because they have a personality disorder. And in that instance, I don't think there's going to have been proof that he had serious difficulty controlling his behavior, or that we could say that the jury made that determination.
There will necessarily, in those cases, though, have been a finding by the jury that that personality disorder predisposed the person to acts of sexual violence. And isn't that saying the same thing?
I'm responding to what the state said about hard to, that we aren't committing people that don't have a special disorder that's characterized by difficulty. And I guess that I want to just leave it there and to say something else, because I know I'm going to run out of time, if I may. And that is just to emphasize the limited effect that this ruling is going to have in terms of new trials. There are not going to be new cases with appeals because the jury instruction committee acted promptly and issued a revised jury instruction. It is only going to involve cases involving jury trials. And in the beginning, it was very, very common to waive jury trials, thinking that a judge would be much less offended by the content of the evidence. It's not going to be an impediment to the state proving their case in many cases. I don't agree in Mr. Laxton's case that it was harmless, but as Hendricks and the California case, which the state has supplied the court with recently, there are people who admit they can't control their dangerous behavior. It's not a contested issue. So there are going to be cases where this court is going to, or another court, will say that it was harmless. And as pointed out in the state's case, there is right now a periodic review that the person's entitled to that would involve the same witnesses, it would involve the same issues, with one exception, that the periodic review, the state has the burden of proving that the person would be substantially probable, if not continued in institutional care. And that is something that is mentioned in Justice Thomas's decision, that the person's going to be dangerous if not confined or if not incapacitated. And what does that refer to? That refers to control. We commit people for control, care, and treatment. And if they have to be committed, it's because they can't control. But these are sophisticated concepts that we have to explain in explicit language to the jury. And I'd ask the court to grant the relief requested. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maloney, and thank you, Gray, for excellent arguments on a challenging case. And that concludes our arguments in June 2002, and the court is adjourned for oral argument until September 2000.